Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to the March 1st edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Diane. I think you're lying. It's not March.
We made it to March. We did.
Okay.
At least the calendar says March, even though it's still saying winter. I'm saying it's spring.
Okay.
Maybe if I say it enough, it'll be it.
All right. I'll stick with that. It's really sunny out today.
Well, it was for a second. Anyway, we have actually a pretty big show tonight. We're going to move right along. The annual bike summit is next week.
Yep.
It is indeed in Washington, D.C. It's about to get underway, and I always check in with D.C. insider Keith Laughlin about how transportation issues are faring when 800 people, advocates, are preparing to go up on the Hill, as we say, and knock on legislators' doors. Keith is the president of Rails to Trails. He has a long history inside the Beltway. He also has some interesting developments from Rails to Trails to share with us. So that's going to be fun. My favorite Ohio senator, I have to say that because he's the one I talk with, Senator Sherrod Brown. He is the Democratic senator from our home state of Ohio. He's always gracious and welcoming to our delegation at the Bike Summit. He will be with us today to tell us a little bit about the current state of the transportation bill and about infrastructure. And possibly, maybe that bill will come to a vote on the Senate floor this year. Never mind. That was just a joke. I was going to be speaking with Licking County prosecuting attorney Kenneth Oswalt. He is the prosecutor in the case of Katie Paul, who hit and killed Bob Lennon, the coach from the DeSales High School, last fall. Sentencing for Ms. Paul was this past Tuesday, and he had asked me to talk with him after sentencing. This week he was just too busy, but there's been so much chatter. The Columbus Dispatch has been getting letters and comments, mainly from people saying that Katie Paul got a raw deal. She was sentenced to 4.5 years, which I don't think is a whole lot, for hitting her second cyclist, only this time she killed him, and then left the scene and was under the influence. The maximum sentence could have been 8 years, and the judge gave her 4.5. He also fined her a considerable amount of money, and I think he suspended her license for life.
I think the reason that people are upset that the judge sentenced her to anything at all is simply because she's in a wheelchair.
Well, she did show up in court in a wheelchair. Yes, she is a type 1. She has type 1 diabetes and had to have a foot amputated. I'm not sure why that has any bearing on the fact that she was driving a car under the influence and hit and killed a cyclist and then took off. To me, those are two separate issues. Yes, she is somewhat remorseful, but this is the second person she's done this to, that she just didn't kill the first one. I don't think 4.5 years is a long time. That's just my personal opinion. Evidently, the judge didn't either. Remember when we said that people could write letters?
Yes.
They got over 100 letters in support of Bob Lennon and his family. So that was really, really cool. So unfortunately, we did not get to talk with the prosecuting attorney, but we did get the results. So, and it's kind of a victory in a way for cycling that certain police departments are beginning to actually take notice and prosecute these people. So finally, people have been asking about this for a long time. We will learn about the much-anticipated Copenhagen Wheel.
I'm excited to learn about
it. I know. The project is finally coming to fruition this May when the company Super Pedestrian begins shipping the wheel to consumers. We wanted to know how it works, what it will do, why it is so innovative, and we have their engineering manager, Eric Barber, joining us on the show. So we will squeeze in a little bit of news. It might be tough, but since time's a-wasting, let's welcome Keith Laughlin, president of Rails to Trails, back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Keith, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks, Diane. Great to be here.
So the Bike Summit's coming up next week, ramping up to it. I always like to check in with you, get your perspective on what's happening with transportation. Rails to Trails released a new policy platform on February 11th. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it and how it's going to tie into any new transportation initiatives this year?
Sure. The current transportation bill, MAP 21, expires on September 30th of this year. Now, there aren't many people who think they're actually going to do a new bill by then. They'll probably just extend it into next year, at least. But we want to be ready, and so we have put together a new list of policy objectives for the next transportation bill. And we called our report Safe Routes to Everywhere. And we want to try to create safe places to walk and bike everywhere in America. And what's, I think, distinctive about this report is who our partners are. We really are reaching outside of some of our the usual suspects of our friends in the trail and bike community. And we're working with some people that we haven't really worked with much before. They include America Walks, which is a group that's beginning to build a national walking movement. It includes the American Public Health Association. It includes the American Academy of Pediatrics, who are very concerned about childhood obesity. And it includes a group called Locus, which is a group of green developers who make their money out of creating walkable and bikeable places. So what we're looking to do is to bring a whole bunch of new voices to the debate, to the transportation bill, to argue for why we need to create more places that are safe for walking and biking.
Well, you and I spoke, I think it wasn't at this Interbike, but at the previous Interbike, so that would have been 2012, about this particular initiative and that it was just starting to ramp up. So you're getting health partners. Are these people going to be showing up at the summit? I know you're always there. So are these other players going to be there also?
Some of them will be at the summit. Some of them were actually going to be hitting the Hill this week with the report that we released to the Hill last week. So this is going to be sort of an ongoing wave, some this week, some next week with the summit, and we'll continue to have meetings on the Hill after that. So the summit is one of the pieces here, but we will have an ongoing presence with this group of people.
And what is, if we were to sort of encapsulate what you're trying to accomplish with these different players, what is it you're asking from the transportation bill or from Congress?
Well, there's really two things. One is we want a bigger share of the funding. We've traditionally had about a penny and a half of every dollar in the past, and that got cut during the last transportation bill. We're saying that the next transportation bill should include at least 3 cents of every dollar should go towards active transportation for walking and for biking. But in addition to that, it's not just about money. We want them to establish an active transportation program at the USDOT that will focus on creating networks that actually connect people and destinations, the notion of safe routes to everywhere, so it's easier for people to get where they want to go by not having to drive a car. It's to give people more transportation choices.
Yeah, we were just having this conversation about social justice and what that means. I was having that conversation with Carrie Caffrey and a few other people, and it seems that social justice must include the ability for people who might otherwise not be able to get to work or get to school or even find a job because of lack of transportation, have the opportunity to have transportation.
That's absolutely right. And we have in the city of Washington, D.C., where I live here, I think it's about 35% of the households don't have a car. For some people, that's a matter of choice. They choose to live car free. But for others, it's an economic issue. And so the question then is, how do we create a system of walking and biking connected to transit that gives people that opportunity, that gives them mobility that they need to get to their job, to get to, you know, to do their shopping, to do all of these kinds of things if they don't have access to an automobile?
This sounds like a broadening of Rails to Trails' original vision. So how is Rails to Trails Conservancy changing with this new initiative? What's changing in the structure of your work that is involving all this kind of urban stuff?
Yeah, it has changed. And I think when we began, most of our work was on building, you know, individual trails on rail corridors, often in rural areas, mostly for purposes of recreation and open space preservation. And I think we've changed because, you know, the American landscape has changed and the demand has changed. And so now we're building trails in urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas for lots of different purposes, some of it for health, economic development, transportation. But in addition to that, as we now have over 21,000 miles of trail, and as it begins to connect together, you start to get this notion of creating networks. And this is where it's important to connect it to on-road cycling, to connect it to transit, and to make these other kinds of connections that really make it not just a recreational facility, but also part of the transportation network. So we're evolving as an organization, as the sort of the work itself is evolving.
Well, you know, that kind of brings me to my next question, which is about a court case that was brought to the Supreme Court. We're waiting for a decision. It's Marvin M. Brandt Revocable Trust et al. Versus the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about that case and why this case was brought to the courts?
Well, it's a complicated issue that I'll try to boil down, but this is a case involving a rail trail in Medicine Bow, Wyoming, and it really comes down to a question of who owns the underlying land underneath a piece of this trail after the railroad service was discontinued. And it's primarily because a lot of the railroads west of the Mississippi were built on federally granted right-of-way, which means all of the land originally belonged to the federal government. And so as they were providing, they then gave some of that land to the railroads to build the Intercontinental Railroad system. And there's just a question of property law as to when the railroad ceases to operate, does that corridor remain in the federal public domain, or is it given to adjoining private landowners? And that's the question that the court will have to decide. And I went to the court and heard the oral arguments before the Supreme Court, and I have to say I couldn't handicap this. I think it could go either way, but I think, you know, we've got our fingers crossed that they're going to rule that this should remain public land and shouldn't be the kind of thing that then accedes to the adjoining landowner.
Well, of course, two or three things are going on. One, if it goes in favor of the landowner, it sets a precedent about that.
Yes. We don't even know how broad a precedent this could be, but we're very concerned that it could be pretty serious. It could
Sure.
affect lots of other trails.
Well, and then you also have the situation of if these landowners never really owned that land to begin with, it belonged to the railroad and it came from the federal government, why would these landowners think they have a right to it, I guess is my question.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think
okay.
the problem is we've got two different – we have a previous piece of legislation passed by Congress that says that land shall remain federal land, and as part of the you know, public domain, it should remain in public hands. And then we have a Supreme Court precedent in a somewhat related case that said it should go to adjoining landowners. And the law was written, I think, like 1910, and the previous case was decided in like 1940. So now the court's trying to decide which way does this go? How does this particular case fit into those two different circumstances? And as I said, I would find it very hard to handicap this. We will find out in June when
okay.
we expect to hear the court's ruling to be announced.
And we will watch that because it seems to me like it's important for not just Rails to Trails, but just for the access to some of these railroad beds that are still, I know there aren't that many that are still available relative to what's out there already developed, but it's kind of a scary thing that that it might interfere with already existing trails.
That's right. It is scary. We don't know how broad the precedent would be. And so that's one reason that we've been, you know, and so we, Rails Trails Conservancy, we filed an amicus brief with the court, with five other trails organizations in support of the Justice Department, which was arguing our side of the argument. So we've got our fingers crossed.
The Supreme Court won't listen to anything else. The arguments are now closed. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. So no sense in trying to contact your senators, for example.
No.
Okay.
Nope.
So the last thing I want to talk about is your Trail Link app, the Rails to Trails Trail Link app. I know it is sort of unique and one of a kind. Explain the Trail Link app. I know we've talked about it in the past, but now we're coming back. Hopefully the snow will eventually go away and
right.
we'll eventually get spring and people are going to be back on the trails.
Yeah, for the last 5 years or so, we've been very busy building a website, traillink.com, where we've now accumulated over 25,000 miles of trail maps that are searchable database, so that it makes it easy for you to find a trail near your house. And we've had tremendous, we had 5 million unique visitors to this website
wow.
last year in 2013. And
that's
so
amazing.
The demand for it, yeah, it's crazy. It's, people want safe places to ride. And so that's where the demand is coming from. But right now, for the first time, we've just released the app for this so that you can now take all of this information on your iPhone out onto the trail, because in the past it was primarily used as a planning tool to let you know where the trails were to plan a trip. But now with the app based program on the phone, you can actually use it as a navigation tool where
wow.
you can be out on the trail, you can see the map, you can see where the blinking blue dot is on your phone, and you can actually use it to navigate when you're out riding on a trail.
And this will work only on Apple devices, or will it be working on all of the smart, quote-unquote, smartphones?
it's only Apple right now.
Okay.
But we entered into a contract last week to do the Android version, and
Good.
We hope that will be available sometime in the middle of the summer. That's our plan, but we were doing them one at a time.
I'm sorry, I'm going to probably miss you in D.C. again. It's always a pleasure to see you, and I like catching up with what's going on with Rails to Trails. We are going to watch this Supreme Court case. The decision will be handed down in June. We will watch your new initiative and some of the new things that are happening with transportation. Thank you so much for talking with me on the show, Keith.
It's a pleasure, Diane.
All right. We'll catch up again.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Keith Laughlin joined me from his office in Washington, D.C. Rails to Trails will be at the Bike Summit next week, and it will be interesting to see how the new Rails to Trails initiative works out as they begin to roll out some of these new ideas. We are staying right in Washington, D.C., and we are going to go over to the Senate office building to speak with Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. Hello, Senator Brown. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist.
To be with you. Thanks.
Yeah.
Again.
Yes.
Again.
We haven't talked in like almost 2 years, so I want to get right to the heart of what's
happening.
It's
hard to think about cycling and snow in the east side of Cleveland, but go ahead. I mean, some people snow, cycle, and anything, right?
They do, and today is horrible. Just horrible. It's like 16 degrees, no visibility, and it started to snow again. I'm so over this winter.
Yeah. My wife and I just moved from the west side to west side suburbs into the city of Cleveland on the east side. And I mean, this is a snowy winter anyway, and then you add on top of it, you move to the east side. And I mean, I bet I've shoveled snow 20 times. We have a small side, kind of a short sidewalk and a small driveway. And I'll go out and shovel two or three times a day just to get the damn car out of the driveway.
That
is correct.
Or my
bicycle out, either way.
Yeah, well, believe me, nobody wants to take a bike out right now, including me.
Okay.
So you want to talk about transportation?
Sure.
Okay. I read that this new bill, the Transportation Empowerment Act, it was introduced by Senator Lee and Representative Graves. explain the bill and why they want to do what they want to do and whether it makes sense.
Well, there are people in this country, in the Tea Party types, that think there should be less federal role in the whole transportation system, but they don't read history. I mean, the reason we have the kind of transportation system we do in this country is because of partnerships, federal, local, state, and local communities, businesses, organizations like whether it's a cycling club or a hiking club or people that want walking paths in metro parks or whatever. And, you know, the whole interstate system, you has to be a federal system. And they want to back off all of that and lower the gas tax. I mean, it's real popular, lower the gas tax, I understand, because people are paying too much. But it doesn't get us where we need to go. I mean, drive through lots of places in Northeast Ohio, you see what the streets look like because we don't have the investment in infrastructure that we need, let alone public transit, let alone bike paths, let alone the airports. And the airports aren't what they used to be. That's a whole other issue in Cleveland, but we're not investing the way we need to.
Well, and that leads me right to the next issue, and that's more people are opting not to drive, and urban cycling is growing. Younger people are not driving, and they're moving back into urban areas. So we're not getting support from the federal transportation bill. What might we expect from cities and states for implementing, complete streets and safe routes to school without your help?
Well, I hope so. I think it, I mean, again, it needs to be a partnership. Look, when fewer people drive, and you're right about more people, the number of people living in downtown Cleveland today is approaching 14,000 people. 50 years ago, when Cleveland was a city of 900,000+, only 2,000 lived downtown. So, and, you know, a lot of these are young people. A lot of them are empty nesters. They're not driving as much. Cars get better mileage. Good thing. People are figuring out how to, you know, to drive less. It means that less revenue is brought in, even with the gas tax the way it is. It's not a percentage of the cost of gas. It's the number of cents per gallon. So we don't have the money federally and state that we need to do the whole transportation sort of panoply there of highways, of bridges, of public transit, of bike paths, of all the things in an integrated system we need. So the cities and counties aren't going to do this by themselves. They don't have the money to do it. Just like the city and county, Cuyahoga County and the city of Cleveland and Lake County and Lorain County didn't clean up Lake Erie. It took a federal effort with state and local involvement. A lot of things in this country you need to do. This whole Tea Party, the federal government never does anything right. Well, we have pretty clean Lake Erie. We have a pretty good federal transportation system. Unfortunately, it's decaying because the feds have backed off it because we're not investing.
And the president made some speech yesterday about this entire situation, that we have to invest in infrastructure. That, what did he say? Something about bridges are ready to collect Medicare? Most of the bridges in the country.
I didn't hear that he said that. That's pretty good. Yeah. I mean, you look at this. I find it interesting that a senator from Utah would do this when Utah is a state of, I'm not going to be precise here, not many more, no fewer than 3 million people, I think closer to 2.5 million. And so a state like that, that's a large geographic state, has a lot of miles of highway per person. You know, Ohio has 11 million people, and we're a relatively small geographic state. We're a large population state. But all our highways are spread over a lot of people. Their highways are spread over a few people. So we are more of a donor state. We put more money in because we don't have as many highways per person as they do. So they're a state that's gotten all this federal money building their highway system with not many people paying into the gas tax. And, you know, we're the opposite of that. And this is a state where the senator wants to back off this and say, let these other states go. And it's irresponsible.
From my perspective, I think that having the gas tax even higher, and I know that's not a popular thing, but gas is really cheap here compared to almost everywhere else in the world.
Well, and Senator Voinovich, if he was known for anything here, he was known for one of the things he wanted to do was increase the gas tax because he cared about public infrastructure. And he and I used to work on infrastructure and water and sewer systems in small towns because we knew that they needed some federal help too. And we can't do these things is this whole view that you're going to cut taxes on the rich and hope it trickles down into local communities and makes more money for people and then they can take care of themselves just hasn't worked that way. We've seen this investment By and large, I mean, we led the world in infrastructure. When I say infrastructure, I mean not just highways and bridges, but public transit, community colleges, medical research. We led the world in that for decades after World War II, and we're giving away our advantage. And it affects job growth. It affects manufacturing. It absolutely affects the quality of life, as you point out so well in the show. And we've turned our backs on the next generation. It's just ludicrous. And this whole idea, this whole their whole view of government is all ideology and nothing practical here about looking at the history of the country and what made us great as a nation was a sense of community, not a every man, and I mean man in their case, not every man for himself. And I don't get it.
And neither do I. And we're similar in age. So I grew up at the same time you did. So let me ask about the shift, that it seems to be a slight shift in the gridlock and some things are starting to happen. Do you think this might bode well for the transportation bill actually coming to the floor for a vote this year? Or is that pie in the sky?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know there are a few good signs on bipartisanship. We got a farm bill, which was generally good, not close to perfect, but a pretty good bill that I worked on a good bit because I'm on the agriculture committee. We there's some other signs. I've got a manufacturing hubs bill. The president talked about it. He's talked about it a number of times recently. I'm working with this Republican senator from Missouri. We're going to have a markup in committee next week. That's something that could move through both houses. The immigration bill was bipartisan in the Senate. My currency bill, which will help level the playing field with China, passed bipartisanly in the Senate. So we have opportunities here, and it really gets down to, does John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, he wakes up every day, does he want to be Speaker of the Tea Party or does he want to be Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives? And if he wants to be Speaker of the U.S. House, we get things done. If he wants to be Speaker of the Tea Party, it's all dysfunction and obstruction.
Well, I have one more question, and I'm going to let you go, and that is about some of the distressing things that are going on with motorists and cyclists. We've had several people killed in Ohio this year. One woman was sentenced this week to 4.5 years. This is the second time she hit a cyclist. This time she killed him and kind of ran away. I know these aren't federal laws, but do you have any thoughts about how to make the laws more equitable for cycling or for pedestrians? I mean, we seem to be losing a lot of people because of people in cars who should have had their licenses revoked years ago and then not let back in cars.
Well, I don't have much opinion except, I mean, I have an opinion, but I don't really offer much because it really is up to, I mean, the states, as you know, states and local governments, the states pass the traffic rules and laws and the local governments, by and large, implement them. I think that they aren't necessarily doing it well. They've got, you know, I understand that local police have a zillion duties and it's only getting harder and the states aren't fun. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, a woman in eastern Ohio, and her husband has a job I'd never thought of before. He's a civil engineer. He works for the Department of Transportation in Columbus, has his whole career. And anytime there's a fatal accident, and that means a cyclist is hit, a car collides with another car, a pedestrian's hit, he goes in and looks to redesign where it happened. Why did this happen? Is there a way to redesign the road and the intersection or whatever so it doesn't happen again? I mean, it's that, plus it's obviously prosecution of people that do this, particularly if they have any history of driving like that. And then people will pay attention more, we hope.
That is an interesting job. I never thought of it either.
Yeah, so, it never occurred to me.
Thanks so much, and thanks. Have a great day.
Glad to do it. Thanks.
All right.
See you.
Bye-bye. Senator Sherrod Brown joined me from his office at the Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C. I always enjoy speaking with him. He speaks his mind. We are going to take a short break on the Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back with some news, and then we're going to head on over to Massachusetts and talk about the Copenhagen Wheel. I'm Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna, on the Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University. On Saturday, March 8th, Lake Erie, Inc., a writing space for youth, will host their second annual Kids Comic-Con from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., featuring workshops led by professionals including cartoonist Terry Libenson, comic writer Mark Sumerak, and artist Adil Uzzafar. This event is open to kids ages 8 through 18 and their accompanied adults. A modest registration fee is required and pre-registration is suggested. Lake Erie, Inc. is located at 2843 Washington Boulevard in Cleveland Heights. Registration and more information at lakeerieink.org or 216-320-4757.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
Hey, Tim McKenna, it's time for the news. What do you say?
We have lots of news, but we'll do a couple quick stories.
Okay, go ahead. You begin.
First, for anybody that's interested in the UCI Track Cycling World Championships, if you go to their website, you can follow. They are live streaming for most countries. I tried earlier this week and was not able to follow from the United States, but I'm sure some of you can. But they do have all the results posted and everything else that you might be interested in.
How long are the track championships? How long will they last?
Thursday through Sunday.
And how is the United States doing, or do we know?
So far, we don't know at this time.
Okay. Should we stay with the racing theme a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. This comes from Velo News, from Velo News competitor. Alberto Contador wins for the first time in more than a year. He won a stage. This was written by Andrew Hood. Alberto Contador, who's with Tinkoff Saxo, won on Saturday. That's last Saturday for the first time in more than a year, delivering a morale-boosting victory in the climbing stage at the Volta Algarve. Contador, 30, had not won a race since taking a stage last January in the 2013 Tour de Saint-Louis, but rediscovered his winning legs in the steep summit finale at Malajo, finishing 3 seconds clear of runner-up Rui Costa of Lampre Merida, with overnight leader Mikhail Kwiatkowski, Omega Pharma Quickstep, crossing the line 10 seconds adrift to retain the leader's jersey. Chris Horner crossed the line 7th and 14 seconds back after trying to set up his world champion teammate Costa for the win. Nice to see him back in winning jersey form.
It's amazing what a win can do for you.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. What else you got?
Well, in keeping with a win, after the Tour of Oman, Danish cyclist Matti Breschel suffered extensive injuries after being struck by a flying mattress.
I read that headline and I'm like scratching my head going, seriously? How the hell was he hit with a mattress?
We've all driven down the highway or somewhere where we've seen somebody who's got the mattress flapping on the top of their car. They still don't know, as of now, they still don't know why it was flying through the air. Or, as the article says, whether it's a normal occurrence in Oman. I don't believe that it is, but the stage was over and they were headed back to their hotel. They were on a descent and he was going 70 kilometers per hour. And this mattress appeared, hit the front wheel, and
oh, yeah.
He went head over. And he tweeted a picture out with his legs, his arms, his back, his jaw, his everything all scraped up.
Yeah, you know, these guys are tough, though. He'll be back.
He will. But that was the weirdest story that I've ever seen about a sports injury.
Yeah, that's pretty weird. Got hit by a mattress. Bicycle Times magazine, which I have to say is one of the magazines I do read, has a nice infographic about the steepest hills in the country in the newest issue.
Wow.
Yeah. Sherman Road and Old Mill in Cleveland didn't make it.
No.
Okay. No. But four streets in L.A. did. I don't think of L.A. as hilly.
No, typically we don't.
Yeah. But Bicycle Times is published in Pittsburgh, and they proudly had one of their streets highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
So it is 10 steepest streets in the U.S. It's a nice infographic if you want to see it. You could go to bicycletimesmag.com. What else you got?
They have recently just revealed the courses for Richmond. They'll be holding the 2015 UCI Road World Championships. So they have the courses listed, and they're going back to cobblestone. So there is actually riders will face a twisty, cobbled 250-meter climb up Libby Hill is the second-last climb to the finish line in the road race. And it's going to have some cobblestone.
Is this 2015 we're talking about?
2015.
Yeah. I want to be there.
And this is the first time since 1986 we've had it in the United States.
Right. I want to be there. And they Richmond has worked so hard to get that event there. I think it's going to be cool. So this also comes from Velo News competitor. Pioneer Electronics launches new improved power meter. This is by Logan Von Bockel. Pioneer Electronics has launched its second crank-based power meter in less than a year. The Athlete-Lite power meter and head unit. Pioneer, yes, it's the same Pioneer Electronics that made your car stereo and the DJ equipment at nearly every electronic dance music concert, launched its Athlete power meter last fall, but is already replacing the first generation Shimano Dura-Ace 9000 meter with a wholly redesigned model. That's what sort of blew my mind. Okay, it came out last year and it's what, 3 months later and they're replacing it? The Shimano Dura-Ace version of the power meter will sell for $1,850 and the Altegra for $1,550, making the Power Athlete Lite crank much less expensive than comparable SRM models and slightly less expensive than the SRAM Red Quark. What they're not saying, though, is Stages makes a really interesting power crank. You just replace the left-hand crank, and it's a lot less than all of this. So I don't know. Pioneer power meters are built with a design similar to the Stages meters. They're strain gauges, attaching a strain gauge-laden pod to the inside of the crank arms to measure flex. But while Stages takes power from one leg and doubles it, Pioneer mounts a pod on both sides of the crank. Ah, that's why it's so expensive. That means that, like Garmin's Vector Power pedals, but unlike SRAM and Quark, the Pioneer meter measures both left and right pedal forces at the arm. Additionally, the Athlete Lite only adds 66 grams to the Dura-Ace and Altegra cranks, making the Power Athlete Lite Dura-Ace cranks lighter than the offerings from SRAM and from SRM.
I think for a lot of people, this is actually a good thing, and it will help them to train at the elite levels.
Well, certainly power is what it's all about, but you know what? I'm still a big believer in heart rate.
I think that tells you, right. You can see exactly what it says, but right. That heart rate is really going to tell you what the engine's doing.
I think so. You got any more? I got one more. You got more?
Yeah, I've got. You're going to love to hear this.
I'm sure I am.
Los Angeles judge has dismissed, dismissed another fraud lawsuit against Lance Armstrong, ruling that the disgraced cyclist engaged in mere puffery and not illegal false advertising when he claimed that FRS Energy products were his secret weapon for success.
You know, who came up with that?
Here's the interesting part. They explained in the article, puffery is a legal concept that relates to advertising, a notion that companies can make exaggerated or boastful subjective claims about their products and not be held liable for the literal definitions about them.
Sounds like something from the, 19th century.
Yes, only in advertising could we do that. It does, puffery, it sounds like something straight out of Monty Python.
Exactly.
But this was actually one of two cases that were dismissed because of, puffery.
Yeah, they were puffering on something. Yeah, maybe they're in Colorado. I don't know. All right, my last one is a bit of good news for London cyclists. This comes from the London Councils, which evidently are part of the government. Lorries without cycle safety equipment will be banned from London. Subject to a formal consultation and legal procedures, the process could be completed as early as September and by the end of the year at the latest. The proposed ban will require every vehicle in London over 3.5 tons, a disproportionate cause of cyclist and pedestrian deaths, to be fitted with side guards to protect cyclists from being dragged under the wheels. Ooh. It will also require them to be fitted with mirrors, giving the driver a better view of cyclists and pedestrians around their vehicles. It will be enforced by CCTV cameras and on-street checks, subject to approval by the Department for Transport. Chair of London Council's Transport and Environment Committee, Councillor Catherine West, said, quote, London Council's is supportive of further action to improve cycle safety in London and will continue to work closely with the mayor and Transport for London to develop the proposal for a new London-wide safer lorry scheme. London Council's is currently consulting on plans to improve cycle safety in London by making changes to the London lorry control scheme that would require all lorries weighing over 18 tons to have extra mirrors and side guards before being issued a permit under the schemes. So at least they're acknowledging that this is a problem. The last sentences of the 16 cyclist deaths in London in 2011, 9 involved these big trucks.
And I think one of the other articles that I came across that we can talk about at another time is they're talking about 33 of the major intersections in London that they're going to reconfigure. There were, over the last 3 years, 150 cyclists and pedestrians that have been killed. And it's not just cyclists. It's pedestrians as well with the lorries. And with all the technology we have nowadays, I think it's getting much, much easier for that to happen. And one last thing on a positive note, our friends over at WeBike NYC, they're using the hashtag WeBike2DC. And if you remember, they talked about riding from New York City all the way down to Philly to the
Bike
Summit.
That's Liz.
Yes.
Yeah.
Liz Jost. And they're reporting everything that they're doing. And they left on Thursday morning, I think, to ride all the way there. And so
I hope they don't run into that storm.
I think they'll make it. It's probably just a little cold, but they'll get there. So go ahead and
just a little cold.
Follow them at WeBike NYC or WeBike2DC is the hashtag for that.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all the news for the week.
That's it.
Okay. We are going to head on over to Cambridge, Mass. As I promised, we're going to speak with Eric Barber, who is the engineering manager for the Copenhagen Wheel. Eric, thank you for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
There's been a lot of press and a lot of interest in the Copenhagen Wheel, and I want to talk with you about it. Tell us a little bit about the project, how it began, why it began, and then we're going to ramp up to what's going to be happening as it gets released this spring.
Sure. So the Copenhagen Wheel started from a partnership between the MIT Sensible City Lab and the city of Copenhagen, which is one of the world's most cycling savvy cities. The main motivation behind the project was looking at how do we get more people to ride bicycles versus car travel and public transport travel. And that's where the name the Copenhagen Wheel came from, was that partnership.
Okay. And when did the project begin?
So the project began about spring semester in 2008. And it was really a clean sheet kind of project as far as, you know, how do we get people riding bicycles? You know, everything, if the solution was to load them up on espresso, then that's what we'd be doing today. But instead, it was looking at different technologies that were out there and looking at e-bikes in particular, and taking kind of a different approach to what's traditionally been done so far in the e-bike market.
Which is basically put some batteries somewhere on the bike.
Right. It's more of a, you know, let's modify the bike frame, let's hang batteries someplace, let's get a motor, you know, either at the crank or the rear wheel. And, you know, there's a lot of addition of, you know, wiring and controls and things like that. So we really looked at, you know, how you can preserve, you know, the bicycle that you already have, but now seeing this great capability.
Yeah, and I have some questions about how the wheel's going to mount in a little bit later in our interview from the technical perspective. So in layman's terms, how does the wheel work? What is it that is happening with that beautiful red hub that we see?
The wheel is basically a self-contained unit that can be retrofit onto almost any bike just by replacing the back wheel and then downloading an app on your phone to be able to further enhance the functionality. And what it does is it'll capture the rider's energy while you're braking. It has a removable and rechargeable battery pack. And then when you need it, it'll give you a push. It's as simple as that. Over time, the wheel learns how you pedal, and it basically integrates yourself with the rider's motion. So it's a very natural experience. Suddenly, you just feel like you're, you know, that much stronger than you were before, or that a hill suddenly, you know, doesn't feel like a hill. It feels like flat ground. And then, you know, further with the smartphone, there's a bunch of different apps that you'll be able to customize your ride. You'll be able to track the physical activity, collect different information from the environment around you, and then be able to share it with friends and fellow cyclists. We're also offering an open API for developers who want to create software for the wheel themselves in the community.
And I do want to talk a little bit about the whole community thing. I watched several videos, including... and I can't remember her name, but a presentation that she made about getting the environment around you involved. And I thought that that was
sure.
An interesting concept. So I want to go back to the wheel integrating with your mobile device. Is it going to be Android as well as Apple, or Apple as well as Android?
Yes, we're going to support both.
Okay. And so what exactly is being communicated back from the wheel? I don't understand exactly how it is both storing energy and then learning what you're doing.
Sure. So the smartphone itself, what gets communicated to the wheel is basically different ride modes. So if you want a turbo mode, you know, you want to feel like you're, an Olympic bike racer versus, say, more of an economy mode where maybe it's a little bit less of an assist than what we'll offer in a turbo mode, as well as modes that are things like flatten my city. So it detects slopes, and the bike now knows, okay, I just want an assist when there's hills because I'm fine riding on flat ground. I just don't like riding up hills. And then we're also going to offer the ability to kind of further customize how the wheel actually responds. So how quickly it responds, how intense it responds. You'll be able to customize that within the app.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff going on.
You know, basically, you know, the wheel itself is monitoring, you know, you as you pedal. So it understands how quickly you're pedaling. It understands how much effort you're putting into pedaling. And then the control system that we've spent a lot of time developing is really designed to have a natural feel. So, you know, it's a very smooth transition where all of a sudden, you know, you get this boost of energy.
When I looked at the bike that is set up, that white bike with the wheel, with the red hub, it seems to be using a rear-facing dropout. And you said it'll work on pretty much any bike. Is it a quick release system or is it a bolt-on system?
So it's a bolt-on system, but it'll work with any dropout orientation.
Okay.
And we're also offering it in basically two different versions to support 120 millimeter dropouts for your single speeds as well as 135 for your multi-speed.
Can you take the 135 and knock it down to 130 for most road? So you're just spacing it out?
Sure. So what we're doing right now is we're actually looking to optimize a couple components, and our plan is to actually get it down to 130.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Most road bikes have a 130 millimeter dropout.
Right. When I think of 135, I think of mountain bike.
Right, right.
So I have a question that everybody's going to ask, and I didn't see it anywhere. What is the wheel weigh? You know everybody's going to ask that question.
That's right. So the wheel weighs 13 pounds.
Interesting. So 13 pounds. That's not too bad. Are you going to be making it in both 700C and 26-inch?
Yep. So initially, we're going to offer it in both of those wheel sizes.
Okay.
We're also going to offer it in probably a couple different widths for the 700C wheel. So, you know, everything from your skinny road bike tires to your kind of larger 29-inch tires that we're seeing today.
Let's talk a second about repairing the wheel. All right. So, you know, everybody smacks into something, not enough air in the tires, whatever. Is it a standard spoke and rim system?
So the rims are standard.
Okay.
The spokes are custom because of the what we call the smiley-shaped pattern that you see, the way the spoke integrates with the wheel. But
okay.
We're going to sell spokes through our accessory portal, which we'll be releasing in the next couple of months.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I'm speaking with Eric Barber. He is the engineering manager for the Copenhagen Wheel. For all you listeners who have been waiting to know about this, here it is. So let's talk a little bit about the battery charge. How long will a battery charge work? Because I sort of had the sense that it is sort of re-energizing itself as we go, too. Did I understand that?
Right. It will re-energize itself. You know, there is some what we call dynamic braking through the pedals where we basically simulate a coaster brake. So as you're riding along, if you backpedal slightly, there's an electronic coaster brake that'll kick in, and that'll recapture some of your energy during braking, as well as depending on the ride mode that you're in, if you're going down a hill, you'll be able to capture some of that energy as well. But the battery is also chargeable. It takes, 3 to 4 hours to fully charge the battery. And then depending on the mode that you're using the wheel in, it'll give you about 31 miles of range.
It's being designed for urban use. So I want to go to the store, I want to go to work, I want to come back, that kind of stuff. You're not asking people to take this on a century ride.
Right, right, right.
I get it. I want to talk a little bit about this data that can be shared with other people and with the city. What is it that you're envisioning with this data? What kind of data is it capturing other than how fast you're going, how far you're going, you know, how much energy you're using?
Sure. So basically, you know, we're capturing all your basic biking parameters. And what we're also doing is we're opening up basically a section of our hardware where developers are going to be able to integrate custom sensors right into the wheel. So there's a lot of interest for people in different parts of the world to maybe integrate a CO sensor and have a bunch of people ride around with it and collect data, or a CO2 sensor or temperature sensing. So we'll have the ability for people to add that to the wheel and be able to get that information through the Bluetooth link that connects to the phone.
Interesting. And so then you're going to be able to share that with other riders. I sort of got that. But other riders are going to know what your data is. You know, when I think of that, I think of Strava, where you go up and you see what other people are doing. But this sounds a little different from that.
Right. So it's a combination. You know, there's the ability for the developers who want to add more advanced sensors. And then as a normal user, there's the ability to log into a user portal and be able to see, you know, here's the last few rides that you did. Here's where you went, you know, here's how quickly it was. You'll be able to, you know, share that with a friend. Maybe there's a route that you really like, you know, because, you know, there's better bike paths or things like that. So there'll be a kind of a, you know, social network to be able to share that with other riders.
Wow. How weatherproof is this?
So it's, you know, it's designed to work in all environments. So, you know, especially being in Boston and yep. Lately with all the snow we've had, you know, we've been doing demo days every Friday. You know, as long as the road conditions are safe for riders,
sure.
We've been out there. So, you know, it's designed to handle the elements.
I know that the project was originally designed to be used, like, in Copenhagen, hence the name. Are there other countries now looking at it? I know the U.S. is very interested. It's an MIT research. There's that Sensible City Lab at MIT that really was working on it. What are
right.
other countries thinking?
So, you know, right now, we've been offering the wheel for pre-order, basically direct to consumer.
Right.
And, you know, there's been a lot of interest in the U.S., you know, as far as where we're seeing people that are actually purchasing the wheel for pre-order. I think one of the kind of the barriers to entry, so to speak, for e-bikes, from my own personal perspective, is, you know, the price point. A lot of the e-bikes that you see over in Europe, they're pretty expensive bicycles. You know, you can spend easily upwards of 2,000-3,000 euros on some of the different e-bikes that are out there, where, you know, our product kind of approaches it from a different angle where, you know, we've created this wheel that allows you to take this bike that you already love and now add, you know, a new great feature to it.
Interesting. Interesting, because I don't think of a $2,000 or $3,000 bike as expensive, but certainly at the urban level, I probably do.
Right.
You know,
right. I mean, your cyclist who's a road cyclist, you know, sure, that's not considered expensive from a bike standpoint. But I think for, you know, the average user that, you know, you look around the city and you see what kind of bikes people are riding, you
sure.
know, they're older bicycles or they're inexpensive frames.
Well, and then there's the whole, is it going to get ripped off? You know, that's always going to be a fear when you have something so unusual. I mean, if it becomes one of these, everybody's got one, then it's not going to be as scary. But, you know, I'm not sure I would want to leave my Copenhagen wheel bike sitting in a bike rack out front of the coffee shop. What about maintenance? Is this going to be something that the consumer can actually take apart and do something? Or are you going to be training bike shop people? How is that going to work?
So as far as regular maintenance, you know, there should be no more maintenance than what you have with a standard wheel.
Okay.
As far as, you know, the occasional truing that happens to everybody, depending on, you know, how they've been riding, the terrain they've been riding on. And then we're looking at how exactly we're going to develop our service model long term. But, you know, in the short term, you know, we're certainly going to be available to assist people and to be able to handle, you know, bigger issues. One of the nice things, though, that helps us quite a bit is because of the communication with the smartphone, there's a diagnostics capability that we have inherent with that. So we're able to help people know, you know, are they having a problem with their battery pack? Is it a problem with one of the sensors with the electronics or things like that? So we're able to kind of diagnose things remotely and then work with customers to you know, get them, be it a replacement battery or something like that.
Yeah, that was my next question about diagnostics. So, you know, all of the DI2 stuff has computerized diagnostics and you can just plug it in. So that makes perfect sense to me. Well, I only have a couple more questions. One is, are you on track for delivery in mid-May, I think it said?
We're actually going to be releasing a newsletter to everybody who's bought a wheel so far, probably later next week, with an update. You know, we're pretty much on track. There's a couple things that we're doing, I think, that's going to be a surprise for people, which is going to be some, you know, features and things that we haven't already come out and talked about that the team's really excited about. As we've been kind of growing the team the past couple of months and brought on some really great people, we've definitely brought some more ideas and some other things that we've looked at improving. So I think we're, you know, we're definitely on track to have something great this summer for everybody.
That's pretty cool. So my last question is sort of an existential one in a way. How do you think our environment might be changed by the kind of work you're doing with a wheel like this and just with the whole concept of urban cycling, and especially in the U.S.? I mean, obviously, Europe is more set up for cycling, Holland especially, and Denmark. But how do you think things are going to change as more things like this come online?
You know, I think one of the biggest things, and what I hear a lot from different people and have even experienced personally, is, you know, there's a lot of people who live within, you know, what you would say is an acceptable distance to commute in. You know, most people don't want to ride for more than a half hour, 45 minutes before work. And the biggest thing is they don't want to get sweaty. They don't want to have to change or shower, you know, once they get to their workplace. And a lot of times that comes down to, oh, I'd love to ride in, but there's this big hill between, you know, my neighborhood and where everything gets flat and easy. So that's why, you know, I do it maybe once a month. So I think having the Copenhagen wheel and being able to take that hill out of the equation, so now riding's an enjoyable experience, I think that's really, you know, what could be a game changer for a lot of people that are in that type of situation where, you know, they live, you know, sub 10 miles, you know, from the office and now have a way to be able to bike.
I think it's a really interesting project. Are you going to be doing demos other than in Cambridge, in your area, in Boston area?
We are. You know, we're definitely looking at doing them in, you know, different parts of the U.S. and potentially some locations in Europe. I don't have the details on that yet, but I'm sure we'll have, you know, more information coming out as we get into the spring and summer here.
Eric, I appreciate you taking time to talk with me about it. I think it's a fascinating project. It certainly is futuristic that sort of is now, and I kind of like that, you know, that whole idea of we thought this could come someday, and someday turned out to be now. I like that.
Yeah. Right. Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, you are welcome, and have a wonderful evening, and we'll talk again.
All right. Great.
Okay. Bye-bye. Eric Barber joined me from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Interesting stuff.
Lots of questions. You know me. It's a mechanical thing. I want to know more.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things, though, is I don't think that we got that they were going to actually do demonstrations anywhere here in Ohio.
I don't think he knew.
So if you are someone who's decided to buy one of these wheels, we'd love to see one.
Well, or, you know, request that they get them to your favorite LBS, your, you know, local bike shop. That would be cool. I think that will be the way to do it. You have a demo bike at a bike shop, and then you have a demo weekend and get people just to try it out. That'd be fun. Or maybe come to an event with a couple.
Sure.
That would be fun, too.
And I think the technology is fantastic, and it's going to leaps and bounds. It'll move forward, and it'll move quickly and be very adaptable.
All right. On that note, we are done with the Outspoken Cyclist for March 1st. Ah, it's March 1st. I'm so excited. I hope you have a great week. We'll be back same time next week. Have a wonderful ride if you can actually see the ground. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.